From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Senior Thai ministers insist the government plans to press ahead with a poll on Sunday, but the Election Commission is attempting to convince the Yingluck administration to delay it. Former Prime Minister Abhijit Vijaya is now the opposition leader and is considered by some analysts to be less hard-line than other leaders in the current protest. He speaks next to Australian Network's Jim Middleton.
The best course for the country now is for the Prime Minister to talk to the Election Commission. I think they have clearly reported to her on several occasions that the February the 2nd elections cannot be held in a free and fair manner according to the Constitution, and that it's best to have a dialogue or consultations as to how we could have elections that would be accepted by all sides. I'm surprised that after the court ruling on Friday, the Prime Minister has left it rather late. And I felt that if she had met the Election Commission on Saturday and maybe find a solution, the tragedy on Sunday wouldn't have happened.
As you say, Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat has finally, and reluctantly, I might add, agreed to meet the Election Commission. What do you think that meeting's likely to produce?
Well, I think a decision has to be made, whether in principle the Prime Minister feels that it would make sense to set a new date for elections. If she does that, I think the next step, logical step, would be for all political parties as well as civil society to come together and reach some kind of roadmap by which we can achieve both reforms and elections in a reasonable frame of time. But if she decides that she would want to go ahead with February the 2nd anyway, then obviously the confrontation will continue.
But why is it that protesters should be able to stop the democratic process?
Because from the protesters' point of view, they feel that an election is not the answer to the problems of the country, which have suffered from corruption and from abuses of power by the current government before it became a caretaker government. They want to see some fundamental reforms that will ensure that what has happened in the last 4 or 5 months would not happen again.
And do you agree with the protesters that elections are not the solution?
I certainly feel that the February 2nd elections will not give us the right answers. And it's not just my own view. I think it's a view that has been expressed not just by the protesters, but by business organisations, leading members of civil society, academics, and most significantly, I think, the Election Commission itself.
It does sound a little bit like sour grapes, if I can put it that way. You were installed as Prime Minister as a consequence of decisions in which the Election Commission intervened a few years ago. You were unable to turn that into a mandate from the voters. Why wouldn't the world just simply see this as history repeating itself?
I don't think that's the right way of summing up what happened. They were involved in election fraud and they got punished. A new vote was taken in Parliament. I was installed as Prime Minister by a vote in Parliament. I dissolved the House. They won the elections and we accepted the results. The problem came when they tried to pass an amnesty bill, which we had warned them about, that they shouldn't do. It was an attempt to whitewash crimes, including corruption, by the Prime Minister's brother. And basically that led to the loss of trust in politicians and the political process. And that's why the country is in the situation we're in now.
Now, if the election were to proceed on Sunday, you'd not be a candidate. There'd be no quorum in any subsequent parliament as a consequence of your boycott. What would happen then, do you think?
Well, it's more confrontation. And it just raises the point that what is the objective of holding an election when you cannot fill the quorum for parliament?
This whole episode does not reflect very well on the political class in Bangkok, government or opposition. When, if ever, will Thailand's political leaders of all stripes, when will they come together for the good of the country and for its future? When is the good of the country going to come first?
I think Prime Minister Yingluck had a golden opportunity to pull the country out of this cycle. All she had to do was stay off the issue of amnesty, and we would have had maybe, you know, 4 years of her completing the term and no more elections being held. We warned her about that. Everybody warned her about that. But she decided to push ahead. And this conflict will never go away until former Prime Minister Thaksin accepts the verdict of the court and accepts the law.
A disturbing case of torture has been uncovered in the police intelligence facility in the Philippines. 10 police officers have been reportedly been relieved of their posts for being part of a torture cell inflicting pain on inmates for fun. The officers allegedly spun a wheel in a secret room to determine which cruel punishment they would inflict. Brandon Arrow reports.
It's known as torture roulette. Officers from the Philippine National Police Laguna Provincial Intelligence Facility had a list of different torture positions or torture consequences which were chosen by spinning a wheel and then inflicted on inmates. One of the punishments was a 30-second bat position where the detainee was hung upside down like a bat, or a 20-second Manny Pacquiao, named in reference to the Filipino professional boxer, meant a detainee would be punched non-stop for 20 seconds. It's understood sometimes the police officers would drink while playing the game. It was only discovered when a number of inmates complained and the Philippines Commission on Human Rights conducted a routine visit to the facility. The commission's chairperson, Loretta Ann Rosales, says she was deeply disturbed by what they found.
The commission went there and started to investigate, only to discover 44 incidents of torture that had taken place in that cell, in that detention cell. So we started investigating, and that's where we found out about this roulette. It's something that they play with, the police. It goes around and around and around, and it stops, and then points at, you know, one of the labels there. So they had different ways of torture, and to them this was really fun.
According to the commission, the detainees, who were mostly arrested on drug-related cases, complained of being tortured from the day they were arrested to force them to give information. The discovery of the torture ring has prompted the Philippines Commission on Human Rights, as well as Amnesty International, to call on the Chief Police Director General to fully prosecute all the officers involved. While 10 police officers have been relieved of their posts, Ms. Rosales says more needs to be done.
We intend to follow this through and monitor it until such time that the perpetrators are convicted. You know, I mean, I'm sick and tired of this slow pace of the justice system where it just takes too long a time before they are prosecuted and convicted. And, you know, that's already beyond us, but we have to monitor and still make a lot of noise if they don't move fast enough.
Since Benigno Aquino became president in 2010 and reintroduced anti-torture laws, Ms. Rosales says the number of torture cases has reduced. However, she couldn't say if this game of torture was an isolated incident or more widely spread.
We cannot say for certain that it does not take place in other prisons until such time that we're able to see for sure. But, you know, the good side of this is that we get regular reports from provincial jails and also from custodial centers of the Philippine National Police. They give us regular quarterly reports about the status of the inmates. So there's this thing that the CHR does by way of regularly monitoring the activities and the performance of the jail system. But clandestine operations, such as what we have just discovered, is something that we will probably have to look into more closely and scrutinize. But to me, the best way to resolve this crime is the certainty of arrest, prosecution, and conviction of these elements of injustice, these law enforcers who violate the law.
A spokesperson for the Philippines National Police says several officers have been taken into custody and an investigation is underway.
That was Brandon Arrow reporting. The United Church in Australia says it's concerned about the involvement of ANZ Bank in financing a Cambodian sugar plantation. Fairfax newspapers revealed last week the Phnom Penh Sugar Company has been involved in forced evictions, child labor, and food shortages in its 2010 development in Kampong Sapur. Questions over the bank's due diligence are being raised after an audit exposed the project's raft of environment and social problems. Karen Snowden has the details.
Audits undertaken by the bank's joint venture arm in Cambodia, the ANZ Royal Bank, exposed the controversy surrounding the sugar company's forced evictions, land grabs and labour practices. Over a week ago, senior ANZ executives met with Phnom Penh Sugar, community representatives and NGOs to hear their concerns. Through a statement, ANZ says it continues to monitor the situation. Dr. Mark Czernzak is the social justice spokesman for the Uniting Church in Victoria. The church is a shareholder in the ANZ and works with companies to ensure ethical standards are met.
They haven't given us a lot of detail, but they've reassured us they are taking it's their standard practice to take corrective action where these kind of concerns are raised, and that they would normally engage with clients, and if they're not satisfied that the client is making sufficient progress, they may terminate that relationship altogether.
Are you satisfied with the ANZ response to your concerns?
Look, it is a standard response from them on this, and we would sometimes hope that we might get more detail than that, and in some cases in the past the ANZ has worked very closely with us to address concerns we've raised. In this case, we are now in touch with people on the ground in Cambodia, and we will be seeking to monitor and try and make sure that there is progress being made there.
Claims have been made that more than 1,000 families were forced from their homes and land for the plantation of Lee Yong Phat, a government senator and one of Cambodia's richest men. They were paid $100 compensation but have no means of growing food. Mark Czernzak says the bank's due diligence has failed.
I mean, banks obviously have a responsibility to carry out due diligence on the projects they finance and do that thoroughly. Would appear in this case that this one has slipped past what we might have expected the bank's processes to be. It is clearly disappointing that it's come to, we are in this situation, but we would certainly hope that the bank now does the best it can to try and ensure there is a good outcome.
And what sort of recourse do you have as a shareholder with the ANZ?
We have in the past, if we've become very concerned, we have mounted public campaigns to seek to persuade it to take a different course of action, whether they should be exiting that relationship if they can't have any influence.
You said that you've had issues with the ANZ Bank in the past. What were they?
Look, we had previously had discussions with them around a dam they were funding in Laos, and in that case we had a very positive engagement where they arranged for us to actually go and visit the dam site in Laos, but it hasn't meant that all our concerns have been addressed. We've also had engagement with the ANZ previously where they were providing finance to companies that were in the business of manufacturing cluster munitions. The finance was not being used directly to fund the cluster munition manufacturing, but we had concerns about a direct financial association with companies involved in that business. Now, the ANZ subsequently altered its policy and, to our knowledge, no longer holds any investments in any companies that have an association with manufacturing cluster munitions.
Burma's government has been rocked this past week by allegations that its security forces took part in the mass killing of Rohingya Muslims. The United Nations and human rights groups said they found credible evidence of the killings, while the United States and British embassies called for an investigation. On Tuesday, the Burmese government called diplomats to a briefing in Yangon to present what it said was evidence that the incident never happened. But the government briefing failed to convince many of who were present. Jared Faris has the story.
International diplomats and United Nations officials file out of Myanmar's Foreign Affairs Ministry in Yangon. They've just sat through a two-hour briefing by senior members of Myanmar's government, which is keen to convince them that reports of an alleged massacre of at least 40 Rohingya Muslims are false. Chow Yin Lai is head of the commission charged with investigating violence in Rakhine State, where the alleged massacre took place. He said the commission looked for mass graves, followed up on tips that Rohingya were abducted and tortured, and interviewed villagers looking for witnesses to violence.
We didn't really, at least we have yet to find a concrete evidence that really indicate that something terrible might have happened to these people. The only clear evidence we had was the police sergeant was killed.
Lieutenant General Koko, who is Myanmar's Home Affairs Minister, said the incident began when police on a routine patrol confronted a group of Rohingya villagers.
About another 100 villagers armed with knives and sticks began attacking the patrol, even though the team had identified itself. The crowd continued to grow, and the patrol decided not to confront the mob. They decided to withdraw from the area. However, police sergeant Ong Chau Tein was left in the middle of the mob with his M22 rifle. According to police officers who escaped, they heard two shots from the village as they were leaving.
Everybody seems to agree that a police officer died in the January 13th clash with Rohingya villagers. It's what happened next that's at issue. Lieutenant General Coco said police withdrew and called their local headquarters for reinforcements. He said police then returned and cordoned off the village while they began searching for suspects as well as the officer. The United Nations and human rights groups said their investigations have turned up credible evidence that once the police returned in greater numbers, the killing began. Reports of the alleged massacre were all the more easy to believe because it's happened before in Rakhine State. Another problem with verifying reports from Rakhine State is that the government prevents access to many areas, including Mongdao Township, where the alleged massacre took place. Journalists are barred completely and even aid agencies are severely restricted. Myanmar officials promised to conduct a further investigation, but that didn't satisfy the concerns of some in the room. During the question and answer session after the briefing, United States Ambassador Derek Mitchell requested that the investigating team include at least one international member.
What I would ask for then is, if possible, to have an international representative, a credible person from the international community who can take part and assist in that process and therefore reassure people on the ground in Rakhine and the international community that it's not simply the government investigating itself or the people investigating itself, but that the international community can feel reassured.
It was a request that Foreign Affairs Minister Wanap Mongwin politely declined.
We will conduct the investigation in a very transparent and open manner, and we regarded this as an internal affairs of Myanmar. So I am regret to say that we will not be able to include some of the representative outside of the country.
The controversy continues over the alleged massacre, and unless the government allows outsiders to see for themselves what happened, it's unlikely to be resolved.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Members of India's gay and lesbian community say they're crushed after the country's highest court voted to uphold a ban on homosexuality. The Indian Supreme Court has dismissed an appeal by gay activists against a verdict it delivered last December, which recriminalized gay sex and again made it an offense punishable up to life in prison. The bid to decriminalize homosexuality was backed by the government, but the country's main religious groups pushed for the ban on gay sex to remain in place. Michael Edwards reports.
In a stylish apartment in South Delhi, Aditya Advani and his partner Michael play with their twins, a boy and a girl. Aditya grew up in India but left in his 20s. He says the country was in a tough place for homosexual men to live. He thought that had changed when he moved back several years ago. But the Supreme Court's ruling to uphold a colonial-era ban on gay sex has him thinking that the country hasn't progressed at all.
Well, you know, as humans, we always try and stay happy and upbeat, but right now we are extremely disappointed and angered by the Supreme Court judgment and their disregard of our civil rights. And their thought that we don't exist, that we are a minuscule minority that can be wished away. And we're not going to be wished away. We are here, we are created by God, and we are going to be who we are. We can't be any different. So it's really actually a moment of anger for us and anguish. And it's really disappointing that our own country is so disrespectful of us.
It was a huge victory for the gay and lesbian community in 2009 when the Delhi High Court ruled as illegal the section of the Indian Constitution that banned gay sex. But activists were taken by surprise last December when the Supreme Court, the country's highest legal body, overturned the ruling. An attempt to get the Supreme Court to reconsider its decision was made by both gay groups and the government. But this was rejected yesterday. Aditya Advani says it sends a terrible message to the rest of the world that India is a backward country.
These rulings are going to have a terrible impact on people's lives. They are going to push them back into the closet. Gay people were finally finding hope after the Delhi High Court judgment 4 years ago. And now we are pushed back into the closet, pushed back into the darkness, ignored by society. And people are going to feel really repressed. It's going to have a terrible negative impact.
The anti-homosexuality laws are rarely enforced, but sometimes they're used to intimidate and harass gay people, especially those from lower socioeconomic groups. Gay rights groups now have the option of filing a curative petition, which is the last stage of the legal appeal process and is intended to remedy gross miscarriages of justice. But lawyers say the chances of success for such petitions are slim. Despite the setback, though, gay rights groups say they'll continue to fight to have the ban overturned. Anand Grover is a lawyer representing a coalition of gay and lesbian groups.
You have to understand that there's a huge movement which has been built up for the last 10 years, and that movement has a momentum which will go beyond the judgment. So if not now, ultimately we'll win.
The only other path is for Parliament to change the laws, but observers say they see virtually no possibility this will take place before national elections due by May.
Today, January 31st, marks the start of celebrations for the Lunar New Year, and Chinese communities around the Pacific and the world are staging cultural events to usher in the Year of the Horse. In French Polynesia, the main events will be staged in Tahiti, where the majority of people of Chinese descent live and work. There'll be an official opening at the town hall, the traditional Dragon Street Parade, as well as a lantern procession to Kanti Temple in Mamao. The highlights will be, of course, performances from an acrobatic troupe from Guangdong in China, and much more. Isabelle Giroux finds out more from local MP Charles Feng Po, who is the deputy mayor of Papeete and a member of the Sinitong Chinese Association.
My grandfather came from Guangzhou, you know, one of the prefecture of the south of China. So the first Chinese immigrant came from that country, and they settled here, and they worked in the cotton plantations. And then little by little, then more and more Chinese immigrants came. So the Chinese community is maybe important now economically. Yeah, because more of the Chinese are the owners of the shops here, you know. If you take the example of the capital of French Polynesia, Papeete, most of the shops here are owned by Chinese.
According to the 2012 census figures, the Chinese community makes up 5% of French Polynesia's population of almost 280,000 people. But with a lot of mixed marriages, language, the Hakka language from southern China, and traditions are dying down. The celebrations marking the Lunar New Year could be a way to keep the cultural heritage alive.
Maybe we think that is the only way to try to keep a little bit our tradition. Because the new generation, the fourth one, they don't speak Chinese anymore. They all speak French. What has changed a lot, that Chinese people, they get married with French people and Tahitian people, and it's a melting pot here. And a few years later, it will be very hard to find pure Chinese or pure Maori or pure French.
That's local MP Charles Fong Lua, who is also deputy mayor of Papeete and a member of Sinitong, the association representing the interests of the Chinese community across French Polynesia. Each year, Sinitong coordinates the celebrations and cultural events marking the Lunar New Year in Papeete.
So the celebration of the horse this year, it will happen at the Chinese temple, Gongdi, here in Papeete. We have received an acrobatic troupe from Shenzhen, which is the region where most of the Chinese people came from. And then after, we have a parade, Lanterns Parade, very, very famous. Everybody can come and have a lantern, and then they walk from the city hall and then by the waterfront of Papeete and come back to the city hall. I don't know if really they can keep the Chinese tradition longer. I don't know. But myself, for example, I don't follow. really. I speak Hakka. You know, Hakka is only our second generation. The third generation, like my son, my children, many of them, they don't speak Hakka anymore. And more of the students, they choose Mandarin at school or at the college because they know that now China is becoming a powerful country. They know that every year more than 90 million tourists from China are spread all over the world, visiting now outside. So we are thinking of developing our tourism. That would be a good idea to have links between French Polynesia and China, not only to keep Chinese tradition, no, because more and more of the students here, they think the language, the future, I mean, which is very important for commercial exchange, we be with China, and it's better for us to learn how to speak Mandarin.
So tell me, for you, the year of the horse, does it have a particular meaning? Apart from good fortune and prosperity, what do you wish for this year to bring to the community, to French Polynesia and the Pacific? And why not the world?
Yeah, you know, the year of the horse, you believe or you don't believe. You know, this animal, right, this is a very great animal, right, when you see the horse. And the first quality of a horse is what? Is a good runner. But I think the best thing to hope that this year, for all of us, we are crossing a very bad year since 2008. And now we are hoping that this year, the year of the horse, this animal will not run too fast, but run with wisdom. And we just hope that that will be a very good year to renew the country. I mean, everywhere. And to bring us not only happiness, but success in economy. I don't know how is the economy in Australia, but here in Tahiti, in French Polynesia, it's going worse and worse. And we just hope that this animal can bring us warmth and happiness and good health, of course.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. For more information, check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. On behalf of the whole team, Gonghae Fat Choi, we'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye, everyone.